This podcast is a proud member of the Teach Better Podcast Network. Better today, better tomorrow, and the podcast to get you there. Explore more podcasts at www.teachbetterpodcastnetwork.com. Now let's get on to the episode.
Welcome to the Counter Narrative Podcast, a show designed to change the way we talk and think about education. By sharing stories of successes and triumphs, we aim to challenge the dominant narrative that often negatively portrays our disenfranchised populations. I'm your host, Charles Williams, an urban educator for more than 15 years, a current school principal in Chicago, an educational consultant, an equity advocate, and the co-host of Inside the Principal's Office. Let's get started. Hello and welcome back to the Counter Narrative Podcast. As I always say at the onset of this, thank you so much for returning. I have seen a spike in listeners for the year of 2024. So that is amazing. So thank you so much for returning. And if you are new, if you're one of those new listeners, thank you for joining the space. You know, you've chosen an incredible episode to jump into. I get to connect tonight with someone who I hope to at some point in the near future to be able to call a good friend. We've shared spaces, specifically at the Innovative Summits. You know, we've connected in those spaces. We have very similar beliefs and attitudes. And so I cannot wait to jump into this conversation tonight with a gentleman that, if you do not somehow know him already, you will by the end of this episode, and I guarantee you will be closing out this episode and going and following and connecting and learning about all the amazing work that he does. So tonight, I have the one, the only, the amazing Dr. Brian Dinkins. Brian, how are you this evening?
I'm well, sir. I am, and I am deeply humbled for the introduction, and am honored to share this space with you. I'm so thankful for the work that you are doing in the educational space and providing the platform for us to share our journeys, our stories, and really continue to move this work forward that we do for children in our communities.
Well, you know, I do appreciate you. And like I said, you know, I was a little jealous of our friend Katie Kinder. You know, she got to sit on stage next to you at that panel. And I was like, man, I would love to sit next to this guy and glean from, you know, his wisdom and all that he has to share. But, you know, I will settle for a podcast this evening until we're in New York together. So before I go any further, why don't you talk a little bit about who you are? Let the audience know the work that you do, maybe the journey, how you ended up in this space before we jump into tonight's topic.
Of course. So, wow. That's a mouthful in itself, right? I'll do the very best I can without boring the wonderful audience. But I often find myself reflecting on the journey. I think it's important to do that. I'm a Indianapolis native, born and raised here in the Circle City, and fortunate to have been given and educated and raised by an educator, Virginia Dinkins, raised two hard-head boys in the inner city of Indianapolis, Indiana, where we attended Indianapolis Public Schools most of our K-12 educational experience. And so, you know, she served as a special education aide for over 20 years. And I think naturally, she was exposing us to the field of education without even telling us. And so, long story short, I moved around quite a bit. I'm a child who was raised by a strong mom, but nevertheless, the impact of poverty still has a pretty significant impact on a child's experience. So we dealt with some hardships. Homelessness, had some traumatic experiences that, you know, you try to live through and grow through. But ultimately, have been now an educator 23 years after graduating high school with a 1.9 GPA. I have found that even our students of today, when they're not having the opportunity to ground themselves in the value of education, that it just seems like something to do. And so that was me. I had great teachers, but a disinterest in education because I didn't see the value in it. But that 1.9 GPA, after connecting with a coach, mentor, and even call them pops, you know, helped me to see that there were opportunities if I would just change my mindset and invest. And so I did end up at Purdue University, studying psychology and playing football for the Boilermakers, which I thought was going to be my career. You know, we're in playoff season now, and I'm watching coaches resign and retire, and I'm going, man, what a story it would have been if I had actually made it to the NFL and stayed. But here I am in the best job and field that there is, and that's the field of education. So after Purdue, came back to Indianapolis, started substitute teaching, and found my love for education, pursued and a degree in special education, taught exceptional learners for several years, and then I went into leadership. And so had the opportunity to serve as principal of four schools here in Indianapolis, all high poverty urban schools in the same community that I grew up in. And it has been my heart's joy to continue that work even today, serving schools here in the city of Indianapolis and schools across the country with emotionally inclusive practices, which is the framework I was able to develop out of my doctorate work at Ball State University on the emotional intelligence of teachers' impact on the behavior outcomes of children from urban communities. So here I am, Dr. Williams, and a servant, and loving everything that I have the opportunity to do in the field of education.
Man, I love it. I love it. And I know earlier, before we started this conversation, before we hit record, I should say, you know, I told you that we would have this conversation. We'd learn about some of those connections. And, you know, I too am a Boilermaker. So boiler up.
Oh, go. Boiler, yes. I didn't tell that, man. Oh,
yeah.
And, you know, forever.
forever. And I was going to go to Ball State, but one of my daughters actually started her educational career at Ball State. But I did start my leadership journey at a charter school that was chartered by Ball State. And so, you know, we always talk about these small worlds. So, you know, that's phenomenal. I love learning about these connections outside of just the work we do, the educational space. Like, yeah, we definitely have some similar histories there.
That's pretty cool. That, dinner on me in New York, man. Absolutely. Let's do it.
sounds like a plan. So, Brian, let's jump in, right? I mean, I love this idea that you have created this framework, right? That's talking about like this emotional intelligence, is this need, especially for, as you and I both understand, coming from spaces where, you know, we might have been raised by strong people, but right, we've had that single family. Like you, I remember moving almost every season. Right. We were in a different home, and it wasn't because, you know, somebody got bored. You know, we were rent dodging. It's literally what we were doing. So I, you know, in all the things that come with that. And so we get it. We understand how that impacts our students. And so I'm curious if that is what's weighing on your heart tonight, or if you want to go into someplace else. But what is it that you want to dive into tonight?
Yeah, that's good. I appreciate that. As a starter, just to give a little bit more feedback about the framework, I got to Ball State and was introduced to an ACE assessment in my coursework. I had never heard what an ACE was, what an ACE assessment, or even trauma. And what blows my mind is at that point in my educational journey, I had been a principal, two schools, had been a teacher serving special education children, beautiful children. And no one had ever educated me about what trauma was or its impact. And so I took an ACE assessment and I scored an 8 out of 10. So here I am serving others, a child who's experienced traumatic events and have never had the opportunity to really explore the impact of those traumas or even how they may have impacted or were impacting my ability to serve others, the conditions that I was creating as a school leader or had as a teacher, and even thinking about serving in historically marginalized communities. We were not talking about trauma that our children possibly were experiencing and the behaviors that might have been manifesting as a result. And so it really was eye-opening because, you know, we oftentimes are expected to be the smartest people in the room. We are educators. We are the leaders of our space, whether that's our classroom or our schools as leaders. And oftentimes there are gaps that allow us to do our jobs effectively. And so it was a dark time for me because learning about trauma, but not having the skills or strategies or solutions or opportunities or therapies to address those made it even harder for me to accept my current reality. And so I then was introduced to emotional intelligence, and I took a EQ appraisal and again, bombed it. It was terrible, but spent 6 months practicing the strategies that allowed me to build my EQ and manage the triggers that I had learned that I was the manifestation of trauma. And I said, wait a minute, if this journey of building my skill and elevating my awareness of my past and its impact on my present and my ability to serve children and communities at higher levels, why not provide these experiences and these learning opportunities for teachers, leaders in my own community and abroad? And so I think and have observed, as I'm sure you have, sir, with the work, the body of work that you're doing, that there are still relatively significant gaps in our teachers' self-awareness, their understanding of their journeys, and the impact that it has on the way we serve children. I think it's been so easy for us as an educational community to blame achievement and behavior and culture on children rather than really digging in on opportunities that we can improve and grow and be the best versions of ourselves so that we can be better for children.
You know, Brian, I appreciate you pointing those pieces out. In fact, one of the sessions that I do, I'll be doing it in New York, is ACEs and PCEs. And, you know, oftentimes they talk about, or educators that are in that space, they were like, well, we've heard of ACEs, but we've never heard of PCEs, right? Which, like, well, that's important to counter. But even during that brief time that we're together, I think a lot of the work that we do is that self-reflection piece. Like you said, we like to place blame, right? We engage in that discourse one. We point fingers. We externalize. But how oftentimes do we engage in that discourse too, right? And we do some self-reflection, that really difficult, hard work. And in fact, I'm reminded, like in the Castle framework that talks about, you know, for adults to understand SEL, like how can we possibly, right, teach students how to navigate those spaces and how to regulate and identify emotions and, right, if we can't do those things. So I'm glad that you're bringing this piece up because, you know, my score is a 7, right? And so we've been through the things, and if we can't understand how we're impacted, we don't know how we're impacting the spaces that we're showing up in. And if we can't do that with ourselves, how can we identify that in the students that we're serving? And so I'm glad that you're bringing that up today.
That's so good and so true. You know, I'd say in this 2024, this year of 2024, I feel like I'm on a mission to really investigate our leadership in schools. I know you know this. We as school leaders often have the opportunity to create the conditions for this learning and growing. But if we're not aware, it's very hard for us to create those conditions for teachers. I find often that principals will have me come to do training for their teachers, but then they disappear. It blows my mind because I'm going, how can you ensure that this work is embedded and ingrained in your daily systems and your programming, your curriculum? If you're not leading and as a transparent practitioner to galvanize your stakeholders and you all go on this journey together. And so I'm looking forward to seeing the opportunities in that in this year.
So I'm curious then, why do you think this is, right? I mean, the idea of SEL isn't new, right? It really came about during the pandemic, or I should say it resurfaced. It gained this prominence within our educational space. And again, I know in some spaces, right, SEL is a dirty word, but we have these honest conversations in this space anyway. But right, it's resurfaced. And yet, as you pointed out, we often focus on, we try to do this work with our students. We don't understand on our, like, why do you think that is? Why do you think it is so hard for us as adults, as educators, as school leaders, to engage in this emotional intelligence work, to reflect, analyze, to look inward, so that way we can better serve the people around us? Why do you think that's such a big challenge?
Yes, sir. That's a great question. Well, you know, here in Indiana, for a time, there was a debate, and even almost a political warfare around the language of SEL and the value of SEL in our schools and communities. And, you know, what I think was uncovered during that time was you were having folk have a conversation against it without truly understanding what it meant, right? So when you think about emotional intelligence, it requires that you do some deep investigation about your emotional well-being. And sometimes that doesn't feel good, right? You know, when Castle began to expand their work across the country, there was a heavy emphasis on child development, right? Their SEL, their skills. And we soon learned that, again, and you just said it, that we can hardly advance children's ability to monitor their emotions and respond in proactive ways if we don't have the adults do it and grow that skill as well. But what that requires is that the adults engage in this work, right? Mm-hmm. So in many of the schools that I work in, none of them has ever taken an emotional intelligence appraisal. In fact, most of them assume that they have high levels of emotional intelligence. And so when I provide them with an emotional intelligence appraisal and they get their scores, so many of them have such a hard time with it because what they've just learned about it is they are not as self-aware or socially aware or manage their emotions or even develop relationships as well as they had thought. And so then what requires of them is a commitment to build the skills through practice, repetition, and then application so that it can truly influence and change the emotional well-being of their classroom. All of that requires so much on top of the academic expectations that we require teachers to be working towards every single day. But what we're seeing is teachers are not able to get to that academic learning because there's so many barriers that are directly attached to the emotional well-being of children and adults in the classrooms.
You know, I can only imagine sitting in a space like that, right? Where people are like, no, I'm good. I almost imagine that meme with a dog sitting at the table, right? And there's fire all around. Like, this is fine. I'm fine, right? Like no, we're for the most part, we're not okay. And we're not just naturally okay. And that's a normal thing, right? Like we have to understand that there are these gaps and that there's work that we can do. And so for those of you listening, right, like we were mentioning ACEs, which is right now there are these 10 questions, right, which ask all sorts of things. It gets a little uncomfortable. So you can go find those online and assess yourself. That's where our scores we're talking about. There's emotional intelligence. I'm sure as we close this out in a little bit here, you know, you can get some of those resources from Brian, but it's definitely important to begin doing this work on ourselves, right? Because what I'm hearing from you is that this is a normal thing. These are things that we are dealing with. And oftentimes we have not been created the space, one, and dare I even say, has it been normalized, right? Today, I was having a conversation with one of my colleagues, a young male, and as an older male, I was kind of, you know, coaching him through. He's just gone through a breakup. You know, we were having that conversation about like, what does it mean to be a man? Right. And talking specifically about the fact that at the end of the day, you're a human, you experience emotions, and it is okay that you have emotions. Right. And I don't think that we have those types of conversations enough. We don't normalize pain and trauma and, you know, emotions. And it's, so I'm just glad that you're saying this is where we need to start. Like, let's put a pause necessarily on focusing on kids. Not that we're not going to focus on kids. I'll reword that. But like, definitely ramp up doing that self-work before we can start working on others.
Oh, that's so good. You know, there is a movement that I'm okay with school and district leaders taking advantage of, and that's the self-care movement. That's Yeah, that's a great question. So what I learned, and I'm continuing to learn through my process of self-exploration, was there's a process that most of us should go through in order to truly get the outcomes that we hope for. And I place these four phases, even within my framework, when I'm providing support to schools or districts. And the first phase is awareness. So much of the work that I do initially with schools, and anybody that's listening to this podcast can engage in this same process. And that is educating ourselves as much as we possibly can about emotional intelligence, about trauma. And even if we just stayed in those two, right? Because there's a number of other opportunities for learning, but let's just say those two. And you could literally go to the CASEL website, or you could go to Google and put emotional intelligence in school or SEL in school and begin to educate yourself about emotional intelligence. I would say after awareness has begun, the second phase is really investigating your attitude. How do you feel about what you're hearing or what you're learning? And the reason for that is because when we have a positive mindset about something, an idea, a strategy, there's often a higher level of engagement with it. And so I try to soften that for teachers by using language like self-care, because we know that's something that we all need. And I think culturally, our mental health professionals, we understand being the healthiest version of ourselves requires self-care. But when we develop our awareness, investigate our attitudes, the third phase is then aptitude. So in order to truly grow, we have to commit time to developing the skill, and skill requires practice, repetition, more awareness, more reflection, more practice, so that we can get to the final phase, which is application. I call it the four A's: awareness, attitude, aptitude, and application. It will be very, very challenging to grow our responses to negative events or behaviors or environmental conditions. I love your example with the young man. And when I think about that story, I go, I wonder what his exposure to emotion was in school, right? Because we throw books at kids, which is vital to their academic growth. But how do we prepare them for the emotional ups and downs that come with just being a human being on the earth? That requires practice. I love SEL focused curriculum, but don't just tell me about it without giving me an opportunity to practice so that I can actually apply it at the right moment. So that briefly is a great opportunity, but just start with developing your awareness and then the rest comes. Spot on. And that, you hope that schools prioritize that for their learning communities. But sometimes it requires one starting with their own journey that gives them opportunities to share. And you've probably experienced this. You have all these wonderful hundreds and sometimes thousands come to your session, and they are given a wealth of knowledge through your experience, your expertise. They take that back to their school and they share, and hopefully that share catches fire, and then it becomes an opportunity to investigate and hopefully becomes a part of their school community, and they invest time in learning so that they can be the best versions of themselves. And so, but it doesn't. So oftentimes it takes time. It takes time. It takes investment, sometimes financial, sometimes sacrifices, prioritizing resources so that you can invest in developing these skills for teachers that then transfer to students. But oftentimes, we just have to start with ourselves. It has been my pleasure, sir. I often say we don't know what we don't know until we know, right? And so I think it's a responsibility we all should hold ourselves accountable to exploring all the possibilities, because the better we are, the better we can be for children. It's been a pleasure, sir.
I want to thank you for listening to the Counter Narrative Podcast. If you're enjoying the show, please be sure to like, subscribe, and of course, share it with friends and family. I'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show, so please leave a comment or two as well. Now, I'm not sure what platform you're using, but the show can be found on Anchor, Google Podcast, Apple Podcast, Spotify, and plenty of other platforms. If the show isn't on your preferred site, let me know, and I'll be sure to get it up and running. This podcast is also featured on schoolrubric.com, where you can find educational articles, videos, and interviews with educators from around the globe. Be sure to connect with me and other listeners by following the show on Twitter at the CN Podcast and joining the show's Facebook group. Take care.